It's Andy Nunez in for New World Order Disorder, substituting for Dr. Johnny Hayes. I've got two great guys. We're going to go from the tragic to the cosmic, from pot to Planet X. It's my great pleasure to have on with me once more John DiNardo, physics expert, man of science, you know, and his partner Gil Erickson. These guys are going to, we're going to go into outer space now, so get your helmets on, pump up your oxygen, and let's head out of the wild blue with John and Gil. Guys, you both on there?
Yes. Hi, Andy.
Hey, good to see you. Good to see all you guys again. Now, John, it's been a few weeks since you've been on with me. Since then, have we got some new revelations about Planet X?
Well, there have been a lot of new Earth changes that we have been seeing. We've been seeing increased weather, meteorological disasters. I've been noticing that the jet stream has been changing even more drastically than it had been over the last about 8 years since I've been following the jet stream on the Weather Channel. The jet stream from around 2004 to 2009 was really bizarre compared to past decades, normal decades, in that the jet stream was undulating, forming what looks like a capital W, a letter W, all across the United States, with the peak of this W extending from Canada and a trough of the W extending all the way down as far as New Mexico, Texas, Louisiana, and this W would roll from west to east across the United States over a period of several days. This was a bizarre pattern, but it was consistently bizarre from around 2004 to 2009 when it began to change very drastically. It started to develop these huge, what looked like letter O's that in the jet stream pattern that would cover several states. Now the letter O's have gotten bigger, and I've seen recently where they cover the entire southeast United States. So we're seeing, and then the patterns of the jet stream are no longer forming a W, but there are two of them now. There's two waves, one wave above around the Canadian border and another wave of the jet stream, which is down along the Mexico, Gulf of Mexico area. So I sense that this change, drastic change in the jet stream, is showing that we're going through another phase in the approach of Planet X, and I get the feeling from other information too that Planet X is now approaching the ecliptic, coming up from below the ecliptic, which is that invisible disk in space on which all the planets revolve around the sun. It's coming up and getting to be close to shoulder with the planet Jupiter on one side of it and the asteroid belt on the other side. This is where ancient historians tell us that Planet X has come through in the past, that is, between the orbital paths of Jupiter and the asteroid belt. So I think we're seeing changes now, too. It's a crazy weather, which is getting more frequent and more intense and more diverse, every kind of a bizarre weather you can imagine. And solar activity, too, is going through another new phase of bizarre activity.
John, I can tell you, today they were calling for, over here in Maryland, they were calling for thunderstorms, then we had a tornado watch. I went outside, the sun was shining, the wind was blowing, I got home tonight, it was blowing, it was windy. I don't know what to wear, what to do, whether to turn the heat off, turn the air conditioning on. This weather just flips me out. Yeah. Now I want to bring Gil on here, so I don't want to feel lonely here. Gil, what's your thoughts on this? What do you think about all this activity?
Well, the problem is that Wormwood, as it approaches, you're going to have waves and waves of different kinds of effects as it gets closer. In other words, what you have is a giant cannonball out there. It's not a planet. It's a little star. It's actually the sun's binary companion, little sister star. And it's probably a T-series or L-series class brown dwarf, so it doesn't have enough diameter to light up and glow like a red dwarf or a yellow dwarf like our sun. But it's big and it's heavy. It's at least the size of Saturn. Could be larger than Jupiter. We don't really know because NASA's keeping that information classified. But it rotates at 90 degrees. its equator cuts at 90 degrees to the equator of the Sun. So the Sun is rotating, and Wormwood is rotating, and they cut at each other at 90 degrees, if you would. So what you get is this wave effect, different things rolling in and hitting us, and then you'll get a small respite, and then here comes another wave of something. And it just keeps changing. And it depends, too, on where the Earth is in its orbital pattern, you know, during the annual orbit cycle.
That makes sense to me, Gil. Now, let me just get clear for the readers. You and John are talking about the same object, Planet X, Wormwood, this dwarf star, same thing, right?
Well, it's a little bit of a controversy there. What it is,
that
we refer loosely to Planet X. Planet X means Planet 10 or Planet Unknown, depending on your interpretation. And it was, the problem was raised in astronomy way back in the 1860s when it was realized that the perturbation of the planet Uranus was explained by the orbit of Neptune, which led to the discovery of Neptune. But the problem was that Neptune was also perturbed. That was easy enough for astronomers to pick that up because both Uranus and Neptune had nearly perfectly circular orbit patterns, except on the June solstice side of the solar system. In other words, if you took the Earth's June solstice and you stretch that line way out all the way to the orbital radius of Neptune, on that side, both Uranus and Neptune had problems. Okay? So Planet X, Neptune was the explanation supposedly, for the perturbations of the off-track problems of Uranus. Well, it didn't quite work that way. When they found out that Neptune was also perturbed, then that led to we need to discover the next planet out. And, you know, this led to the discovery of Pluto, but the problem was that Pluto is just a big ice cube. It's the cube.
They've downgraded it. It wasn't even a planet anymore. Right?
Well, it isn't now, except in the state of New Mexico, by law.
But, okay.
No, it is. It's in the state of New Mexico, Pluto is still classified as a planet, but in the rest of the United States, it's not. It's a trans-Neptunian object. There's about 50 of them out there that qualify. Right. And they're planetoids, but they're not full planets. But the problem was in that when they discovered Pluto, of course, that didn't answer the problem either because Pluto was just so small, it couldn't perturb the orbit of a fly speck. So, you know, what in the world would make a big gas giant planet perturb? And so that led then, in turn, eventually to the discovery of this brown dwarf star problem. But that wasn't until the 80s when that was finally resolved. And then NASA went opaque and kept the information quiet. So,
Planet X, just for the folks out there, Gil, all these little planetoids out there are part of what they call the Kuiper Belt, if I remember correctly.
Well, that's where you find them, yeah.
Yeah, this thing's been out there. Nobody wants to admit it's been out there.
Planet X, Wormwood, the dark body star, the Death Star, is not a planet. It's not a planet. It doesn't orbit doesn't orbit in the ecliptic plane or even in the Kuiper Belt, which approximates the ecliptic plane, roughly. It's at 90 degrees to the ecliptic plane in a long ellipsoid orbit. And so it's normal, perpendicular to the ecliptic plane. It's on its own orbit. It's very big. It's very heavy. It's like a big iron cannonball, Jupiter size. And it's a star. It's not a planet. But even when it's quite a ways away, it still has the ability to perturb and mess up the orbits of the planets that are most proximate to it. So on the June solstice side of the solar system, it was pulling down and causing grief for the outermost planets. That was way back in, 1821. They could see it then. Okay? They knew something was wrong. They just didn't know what. Okay.
I'm with you on that now. This dark star is on an elliptical orbit. That means it's been through before. How long ago has it been?
The last time was when the children of Israel made their exit from Egypt.
Oh, really? Okay. So it must have caused a lot of problems for the Egyptians at that time, right?
Caused a lot of problems for everybody. Blew things
okay.
up, you know, all kinds of earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. You had a land bed that formed between Arabia and the Sinai Peninsula. The children of Israel walked across on it, and then Wormwood just pulled a hole right under the Egyptians, and they went down. So, I mean, a lot of crazy things happened. Dumped
wow.
all sorts of red iron oxide dust into the atmosphere, especially down in the Sudan area, and that stuff washed down the Nile. It looked like the whole Nile had turned into blood. It was a mess. Hmm. It was a mess.
Sounds like it, you know. Uh-huh. You know, and I guess it affected the insect population as well.
Well, you know, when you get these crazy magneto interactions and stuff, you got insects that'll just come out of nowhere doing bizarre stuff because the weather changes, makes the situation good for them, not for you or me or whatever. Again, this stuff comes in waves. It's just wave after wave after wave after wave of different kinds of destruction, different sorts of things that it can do. And it depends on where we are in our orbit, our annual orbit, with respect to when Wormwood comes through. It's a dance in three dimensions.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, okay, but it's coming back. I mean, it's coming
yeah.
closer and closer.
Andy, there we have evidence the U.S. government actually announced that Planet X exists, and they announced that they had spotted Planet X. I have in front of me the New York Times, Sunday, January 30th, 1983, stating
that... You sent me a copy of that, John. I remember.
Right.
I showed it
and
to a couple people. They were amazed.
For people who are skeptical about this, this is an announcement from the United States government that Planet X does indeed exist and that they've...
Oh, I lost somebody there.
Hello?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm getting a dial tone. Somebody got disconnected. Who's left with me? John, is that you? Hello? I don't know what happened to him. Yeah, hello? Okay. All right, folks. Well, Frank's going to try and get him back. I don't know what happened. I think they were invaded by denizens from the outer atmosphere there and got zapped for saying too much about Planet X. You never know. You know, everybody monitors these phone calls. So I probably got the Illuminati, Chaosians, the Satanists, and everybody else listening in here. So probably they were going to say something that they didn't want heard out in the audience tonight, and so probably got cut off.
Well,
anyway,
somebody got the number.
Who's back?
Okay. Picking up where I left off, this article in the New York Times absolutely proves, not only this article, but several others in major publications, absolutely proves that the government of the United States, through its major National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, has announced that this Planet X both exists and that they have sighted Planet X using the infrared astronomical satellite. So it's really been announced, and we have absolute proof of it. So for this, I'll try to give you a couple quotations. One from the Dr. Ray T. Reynolds of the Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California. He says, "We're so sure of this 10th planet that there's nothing left but to name it," end of quote. And they say also in this article, the scientists from NASA say it's most likely a brown dwarf star. Now, a brown dwarf star, by definition, if you look at the definition of it, it's got to be, by most conservative estimates, at least three times the mass of Jupiter. Jupiter's mass is 318 Earth masses. This thing, probably greater than three Earth masses, probably more like 5 to 10, would then be around 1,500 Earth masses. And because of its great mass and its great great magnetic field, it can wreak havoc upon planet Earth and all the other planets in the solar system. As Gil had pointed out, it comes up from below the ecliptic. And there's an easy way to understand it. It's very difficult to explain it using words unless you see a picture. But if you take a quarter or have your listeners take a quarter or visualize themselves doing this little model, hold a quarter in your hand between your index finger and your thumb, horizontally with your index fingernail pointing upward and your thumbnail pointing downward, facing downward. Take a rubber band, loop the rubber band over the top of your index fingernail, stretch the rubber band down along the inside of your forearm. That rubber band describes the orbital, elliptical orbital path of planet X. And you could see your fingernail, index fingernail, represents the sun. So planet X is going to come up. Oh, the ecliptic is represented by the quarter. The ecliptic plane, that is the plane, the invisible plane upon which all the planets revolve around the sun. However, this quarter model, with the, holding the coin in your between your fingers, would exclude the outer planets beyond Jupiter. So that this rubber band comes up around the edge of the quarter, over the top of your fingernail, and comes back down again on the other side of the quarter, and comes back down, all the way down your forearm. That's what's going to happen to Planet X. It comes in through between the orbital path of Jupiter and the orbital path of the asteroid belt, which is right out from Mars. The asteroid belt is the next object field out from Mars. And when it does, it comes looping over the sun and comes back down again over the, essentially over the same point. Through the top of the ecliptic and down through the bottom. When it does this, it's going to cause a gravitational and magnetic lockup or a molestation of planet Earth and the other planets that it passes over. However, we don't know where planet Earth will be in its orbital path. It's like you're driving on a highway, and there is an overpass, and there's a big truck coming on this overpass that you can see above you as you're driving under the overpass on your highway. If you're unfortunate, you know, that truck could be right above you at the instant that you're passing under that overpass, or the truck may not be. So if we're lucky, we may be in that season of the year when Earth is far away from Planet X as Planet X comes looping over our heads on its way to loop over the sun. Do you see what I mean?
Yep,
so if we're far away, we won't get hurt as badly, gravitationally or electromagnetically, we won't get hurt as badly. But
it sounds like we're going to get hurt.
There's going to be two passovers, one coming up to loop over the sun, and the other one after it loops over the sun, it comes back down again. It's going to pass over our orbital path twice.
Doesn't sound good, John. Now, some of the folks on the chat room have asked me, is there any type of telescope or device that they can buy that will allow them to see this thing for themselves? And if so, where can they get one, and how much is it going to cost them?
The answer to that is yes, sort of, but the problem isn't telescopes. The problem is light.
Okay.
The Wormwood is a dark body star. Nozzer doesn't have enough diameter to attract sufficient amperage from the plasma electricity of space, the flow of plasma electricity that lights up the other stars, like our sun.
Okay.
So because it's a dark body star, it's a T-series or L-series brown dwarf, it doesn't have a glow mode in its atmosphere. There isn't a photosphere in it. It has an atmosphere, but it doesn't have a photosphere. And because it's a dark body star, and it probably is a little bit warm, maybe even warmer than the human body, so it can be seen only in the infrared part of the spectrum. Also, because it is approaching from up underneath, or down underneath, let's use it that way, the ecliptic plane, in order to see it, you have to be below the equator. You have to be in the southern hemisphere, okay? It's like an ant sitting on top of a large beach ball. If you put an ant on top of the beach ball at the beach, he can't see the sand immediately underneath the ball. You draw a line away from the ant, you know, at whatever position you put him. And that straight line, that visual line, that's what he can see. But if he's on top side of the beach ball, he can't see the sand underneath. He can only see what, you know, is available to him in field of vision. As you move him down around the side of the beach ball toward the equator of the beach ball, then he can see some of the sand underneath. And as he moves down to the southern hemisphere side of the beach ball, he can see the sand underneath. Well, that's the problem with Wormwood. It's coming up from underneath the ecliptic plane.
So the people who can see it best now are people who live in, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Argentina, Chile, South Africa, and so forth. That's the best place, you know, to go looking for it. But in order to see it, you have to have infrared equipment adapted to the eyepiece of your telescope. And then to verify that it's there, what you have to do is you have to be searching in the correct position, up and down, right ascension 18, and you have to compare optical to infrared images. Wormwood and all the other stars, you know, red, brown, yellow, whatever, will all be in the infrared part of the spectrum because they all give off heat. But Wormwood will not show up in the optical part of the spectrum. None of the brown dwarf stars do. So you have to compare a visual optical view with an infrared view, and that's how you discover it. That's how you see it.
Okay, now let me give you a pop science question on it. Now, there, it's a brown dwarf star. We believe, as far as we know, how close on the, I guess, the range of stars from, you know, yellow, red, blue, white, and brown dwarf are we with to a black hole star, or a black hole itself? I mean, is this brown star an almost black hole, or is it it's still got some life left in it?
It's not any of the above.
Okay.
The concept of black holes is it's quite possibly a fiction. They're not exactly okay. Sure if they can prove that they really exist. There was a problem in astronomy that if you looked at the size and the masses of the stars in a typical galaxy, like the Milky Way or Andromeda or whatever, the problem was, why didn't they fly apart? Okay? And mm-hmm. They couldn't figure a reason why the stars wouldn't just go careening off by themselves. Why do they order up into galaxies and then stay that way for, you know, billions of years? What holds them in that position? Well, then it turned out that if you took the mass of the stars that you could cram into a galaxy, and then you try to add up how much weight would be there, how much mass would be there, there wasn't enough mass to hold a galaxy together. So the Bright Boys figured, well, we have to invent something to keep them glued together, because otherwise the galaxies will fall apart. So they invented the concept of black holes and super heavy centers and all this kind of stuff to try to figure a way to get more theoretic gravity into the picture. And so that's where this, you know, the black hole notions came from. They're not necessarily even there. You know, there's some emissions of X-rays that seem to come out of the centers of galaxies from time to time, but, you know, that could be an electrical phenomenon. So,
Andy,
that may be one of the things where science fooled itself.
Andy, I have quotes from the ancient peoples who had witnessed this planet when it came in, this comet, and this will give us great insight into what we're going to experience. I'd like to read a few of these quotes.
We got a couple of minutes before break.
The writings of Pliny the Elder, an ancient Roman scientist, quote, a terrible comet was seen, so they saw it, by the people of Ethiopia and Egypt, to which Typhon, the king of that period, gave his name. This comet had a fiery appearance and was twisted like a coil, and it was very grim to behold. It was not really a star so much as what might be called a ball of fire. End of quote. Now, quoting Caius Julius Solinus, a Latin author of the 3rd century, writing about the people living on the southern borders of Egypt, quote, the inhabitants of this country say that they have it from their ancestors that the sun now sets where it formerly rose, end of quote. From Pomponius Mela, a Latin author of the 1st century, quote, the Egyptians pride themselves on being the most ancient people in the world. In their authentic annals, one may read that since the Egyptians have been in existence, the course of the stars has changed direction 4 times, and that the sun has set twice in that part of the sky where it rises today. End of quote. In the Holy Bible can be found the account of Almighty God causing the shadow from the great sundial to reverse its direction in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, which testifies to the reversal of Earth's direction of rotation. From Tractate Sanhedrin, an ancient Jewish council, comes the following text, quote, 7 days before the deluge, the Holy One changed the primeval order, and the sun rose in the west and set in the east, end of quote. From the Holy Bible, quote, behold, the day of the Lord cometh cruel, both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in its going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. And I will punish the world for their evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. And I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease, and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. Therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall undulate, or wobble, out of her place, in the wrath of the Lord of hosts, and in the day of his fierce anger. That was from the Holy Bible, the book of Isaiah, chapter 13. In the legends of the Toltecs, who preceded the Aztecs in Central America, we read of a time when, quote, there was a tremendous hurricane that carried away trees, mounds, houses, and the largest edifices, notwithstanding which many men and women escaped, principally in caves, and places where the great hurricane could not reach them. All this time they were in darkness without seeing the light of the sun nor the moon. And one more thing I'd like to read, and this is from the Colburn Bible. The Colburn Bible is an ancient text from the people who have witnessed the Egyptians specifically. Manuscript 3-4, when blood drops upon the earth, the destroyer will appear, and mountains will open up and belch forth fire and ashes. Trees will be destroyed and all living things engulfed. Waters will be swallowed up by the land and seas will boil. The heavens will burn brightly and redly. There will be a copper hue over the face of the land, followed by a day of darkness. A new moon will appear and break up and fall. The people will scatter in madness. They will hear the trumpet and battle cry of the destroyer and will seek refuge within dens in the earth. Terror will eat away their hearts and their courage will flow from them like water from a broken pitcher. They will be eaten up in the flames of wrath and consumed by the breath of the destroyer. In those days men will have the great book, the Bible, before them. Wisdom will be revealed. The few faithful will be gathered for the stand. It is the hour of trial. The dauntless ones will survive. The stout-hearted will not go down to destruction. The destroyer is also known by various witnessing civilizations as Nibiru, Planet X, and Nemesis.
Okay. All right, gentlemen. Well, we're going to take a break right now. So hold that thought. We'll be back in just a second, folks, with more talk about cosmic doom that's coming upon us. We'll be right back on New World Order Disorder. Stay tuned. Okay, folks, we're back on New World Order Disorder. This is Andy Nunez, substituting for Dr. Johnny Hayes. She'll be back next week with 2 full hours of our friends here tonight, John DiNardo and Gilbert Erickson. But meanwhile, we're getting back to basics with solar science, with John and Gilbert, and we've learned about this Planet X, dwarf star, whatever it is, wormwood. Is it the wormwood of the Bible? You guys read Revelation. You know there was a star that fell from heaven called wormwood. A third of the waters became bitter. You know, things were, the land was burned up, the trees. Is this coming for us? Is this coming now? John, Gil, glad to have you back on for this, for our last half hour. You know, what's our chances? What's going to happen?
It's coming. Already headed this way.
So, no getting by. No, this isn't a mistake. This isn't...
No.
This isn't...
The way that it works in the early formation of a solar system, as the glob of stardust from a prior supernova is congealed down by the plasma energy of space, it forms a band around it called a Z-pinch. And this is something that can be duplicated in, you know, a plasma physics lab, how that works. Now, basically, it forms up the glob that constitutes the core of the new sun, if you would.
And that process produces, ends up producing usually two stars, at least 60%, probably more like 70 or 80% of the stars in our part of the galaxy are binary stars. Now, they're not all equally divided so that both of them are yellow, both of them are white, both of them are red, or whatever. Many of them are unequally divided. But they have a tendency to be in orbital pairs. So the Sun has a little sister star. It's also a binary. Remember, if it's 60% of the stars are binary, then that means it's 60% odds that our Sun is also binary. If we find out later on that it's 75% of the stars are binary, then you have to turn that same statistic back the other way, and you'd have to say that the odds are 75% that our Sun is also a binary. I think right now it's 62 or 3, maybe 65% of the stars are known to be binaries, but they're not always equal. So in this case, the Sun's, you know, the leftover from the formation of the early solar system was a brown dwarf and a yellow dwarf, which is our Sun. So the question then is, where is the companion star for our Sun? Okay? Wormwood is the companion star. It is the second heaviest body in the solar system. It just has an odd orbit, and it doesn't come around very often.
Okay, I got you on that. So
it's part of our solar system.
Yeah, but, you know, it's part I could do without, you know, considering what it's getting ready to do to us. You know what I mean?
I'm sorry, God didn't, you know, he didn't ask your opinion when he figured out how he wanted to build solar systems.
Doggone it, we got to work on that.
Yeah, he didn't ask my opinion either. I don't think he asked John either. He didn't ask none of us.
Well, you know, he did ask us to call out to him daily, and he guaranteed that he would protect us, not only in this life, but in the next eternal life. And he states in many places in the scriptures that he who calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved.
Mm-hmm.
In the midst of all this columns of fire and smoke.
Yeah.
And that's what he's urging us to do, because, you know, if we die fat, dumb, and happy with television and barbecues and football games, when you die, you're dead forever. But if you die in fear for your life, and God saves you because you call out to him and embrace him, then you live eternally. So I'd rather go through that fear and call out to God for eternal life than die fat, dumb, and happy with the barbecues and the football games.
Yeah.
Die forever.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Once you're dead, you're dead. Nobody that I've known has come back, you know. So once you're gone, you're gone. That's true, John. Now, the Revelation says Wormwood's coming. Your science,
this is the whole purpose,
all the indication
of it.
Says it's coming. So people out there need to wake up, listen, get right
call
with
out
God,
to God.
Call
exactly.
out
God. This is why God is bringing this upon us, because he's scaring us like a loving father would whip out the belt and start whacking his errant wild children before they destroy themselves. Before we die and go to oblivion, he's trying to save us so we will come to him. Because fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. This is what God tells us over and over again. Just as Noah was told by God to preach destruction in order to frighten the people so that they would turn to God in their minds and their hearts. And the same thing with Jonah. Jonah was told by God, commanded by God, to preach destruction to scare hell out of these people so they would turn to God and thus have eternal life with him rather than eternal death.
Yeah, they worked real good right down to the king. I think the king went down to his personal ash dump, said it, thought ash on his head, said, please don't wipe us out.
You know why? Because there were shown to be archaeological finds that showed that there were earthquakes. God had actually produced earthquakes, ordained these earthquakes to happen in Nineveh at the same time that he sent Jonah marching into the city. So they knew, when Jonah said it, they knew it was coming from God because their earth was splitting all around them.
Oh, exactly. You know, and it's like it says in the Bible, you know, these were, you talk about fat, dumb, and happy folks. As the Bible says, they didn't know their left hand from their right hand. That's how fat, dumb, and happy they were. So if God will do that for them, how much more will he do for us with this doom bearing down upon us?
Well, it's coming. You can count on it because the Bible says it's coming. But you can also count on it because physically that's how solar systems are built. And our solar system is not an exception. If most of the solar systems out there are running around loose, star systems, are binary systems, then you have to ask an honest question for a change. Where is the sun's binary companion? That's not a stupid question. It's a rational question. Where is the sun's binary companion if most of the stars are binary systems? Then where is ours? So it turns out we are also a binary solar system.
Well, you know, the question is also interesting, I think is even more important, is why is it that we, every time that God determined that there was people need to be, the earth need to be destroyed, this comet came in and caused the destruction. So this is like God is on the pitcher's mound hurling this baseball at us every 3,660 years when he knows we deserve a spanking. This is all,
right.
It's just amazing to me that the periodic regularity of this comet, because comets by definition are periodic, every 3,660 years approximately, we can show in ancient history that this planet has come in and wrought destruction. If you go back to 9,000, well, go back to 1660 BC, when we have geological evidence that the great Santorini a volcanic caldera exploded in 1660. That's documented it also in the Bible in Exodus chapter 9 when God told Moses and Aaron to scoop up ashes from the furnace and throw them up in the air in the face of Pharaoh. And at that time, God ordained that this volcanic ash from the great Santorini explosion north of Crete would drift down to Egypt and blanket the entire land of Egypt, but that was just the beginning of the destruction. That this led the people of Egypt, people of Israel, out of Egypt. But 3,660 years, another orbital period before that, takes us back to 5,300 BC, when geologists Pittman and Ryan tell us the Great Flood of Noah's Day occurred, which they had determined from evidence of the Black Sea. So the Great Flood of Noah's Day occurred another orbital period, pretty much precisely before the one in Egypt. So that's 5,300 BC. And then you go back one more orbital period of 3,660 years from 5,300, takes you back to 8,900 BC, or approximately 9,000 BC, when many archaeologists and ancient historians believe the sinking of Atlantis occurred. So you could, the irregularity of God's hand is unmistakable.
Oh, yes, the Atlanteans. I'd almost forgotten about them. They don't get much, they don't get mentioned much in the Bible about that, but that's about the right time period. If you've read Plato, then, yeah, that's right on the money. And there's a lot of evidence, as you said, for the 5,000 BC one, because apparently the Black Sea was, you know, had a wall that broke down and flooded, and then we go on to the Santorini era. I mean, it's like you say, it's like clockwork. I'm wondering what, you know, God is in charge of everything, so it's all awful coincidental that this stuff happens with such regularity. Mankind does something stupid, God drops wormwood on us, and it's like such an even cycle. It's scary.
Yeah. Well, it is, but the honest question, if you're going to look at it, historically, is the problem of why don't we have ancient civilization, more than about 4,000 or 5,000 BC? What happened prior to that? Where are those people? Where are those civilizations? Why don't we have records that go back very far? We just don't have much. We can't reach back even 50,000 years on this planet and know what it was that happened. Our civilization is actually quite young. So, nobody wants to answer that question either. So here's this thing sitting there operating, on its regular schedule, and it just destroys civilizations. If this thing comes waltzing through, things get very messy.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Now, guys, I've got a, we've got a caller on the line. I'm going to let Mark on from Georgia. Mark, Mark's glad to have you on the show. What have you got for the guys?
I got a question about, you ever hear of Dr. Harrington, who knew about Planet X many, many years ago and somehow died?
Well, yes, I quote him fairly extensively in my book. Robert Sutton Harrington was one of the researchers, early researchers, who took the physical evidence problem for wormwood seriously. He had a Ph.D. in astrophysics. He worked at the Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C. under Tom Van Flandern. And what he did was take the perturbation measurements of the orbit of Uranus from where it actually went, instead of where it was supposed to be, and using the perturbation behavior of Uranus, he tracked that forward from the early 1800s and tried to get a model using the standard physics model for perturbing gravitational perturbation. And he came to the conclusion that if we were going to find wormwood, what we had to do is we had to search somewhere between Wright Ascension 14 and Wright Ascension 20, probably closer to Wright Ascension 16, and we had to look for it in the skies of the southern hemisphere. It would not be visible from the northern hemisphere. So he sort of led the world in that one. And then, very shortly after that, it was what, John, it was what, 1992, I think, when he finally died. He'd been a pipe smoker for years, so there's a bit of mystery surrounding his death from throat cancer, but, you know, who knows? He could conceivably have been done in, but you can't prove that now. But the point is that he did lead the way by doing the math the hard way, and he pointed in the general direction of where we need to go looking for it.
Our government did not want him to publicize any more information about that Planet X. They, after having discovered it in 1983, and NASA was quite, the scientists at NASA were quite excited about this discovery because it was a great achievement. However, the secretive people who control our government put a lid on all the information coming out about Planet X following 1983. I've got one article from the U.S. News and World Report in 1984, but after that there was scarcely anything at all. Now, Dr. Harrington in 1988 published a paper, which we have on the internet, in that paper of October 1988, 88. He stated that he was going to send, he was going to, I'm trying to get my date straight, it might have been 91 or 90, but anyway, he stated in the paper that he was commissioning a special telescope, and we have some evidence of a man named Stone, I believe, who actually cut the lenses for this telescope, an 8-inch telescope that he was having dispatched, Dr. Harrington was having dispatched down to the Black Birch Observatory in New Zealand, in the southern hemisphere, where the viewing location was, the optimal viewing location was for Planet X. Dory, and he said in his paper that in this coming year, which would have been 1991, during the viewing months of May and June of 1991, they would take his 8-inch telescope in Black Birch, New Zealand, and view Planet X and send the photographic plates back to Washington, D.C., where Dr. Harrington in late 1991 was to examine the plates. And what happened was he died a couple months after that of esophageal cancer, which is a quick-acting cancer. So the circumstantial evidence is pretty strong that he was about to release this information. A lot of people believe this is true, and that they, you know, they got rid of him because of that, because, of course, any government, no government would want this devastating information to get out that this huge body was approaching our solar system, because it would upset the population, it would change the spending habits, it could collapse the economy. And the controllers do not, to this day, with devastation bearing down on us in the coming months, they are not telling us. They're fudging everything possible, just, you know, deluding, deceiving us with false earthquake magnitude scales, etc. So there you go. I mean, there's a tremendous cover-up, and it's going to lead to the death of many, many millions.
Okay. All right. Well, Mark, thanks for calling on that question. Guys, we're getting close to the end of the hours, but they've got a burning question from the chat room I want to ask you guys. They want to know, how long have we got? I mean, it's sitting out there by Jupiter now. How long till its path crosses the Earth's orbit? Any idea?
No, we really don't know that just yet. However, I have been able to get secondary confirmation. One scientist commented he knows for sure that NASA is indeed tracking Wormwood and has the data on it and has been doing so for years, but that was off the record. And then just this year, late summer, I got confirmation from another observer, probably in southern Latin America, who says that he has definitely seen it. He says it's absolutely there, and you have to observe it in the far infrared. So he was using the correct equipment. So we actually have eyeball on the ground observers who confirm that it, in fact, it is there, and it doesn't matter if the government's trying to cover it up. At least one observer has seen it. Once the amateurs start to pick up on its location, they will force the professionals to admit that they know it's there.
But okay. But no chance of figuring out how fast it's going, when it'll intersect our orbit. No way of getting that data.
Well, do you have access to classified data complements to the National Aeronautics and Space Administration?
I think I left him out of the coat, tell you the truth, but
left John out too, everybody out, unless you were the uppermost insiders.
Well, did get some information as to the coming solar scorching. We got from the National Academy of Sciences, which Larry Joseph tells us is the closest thing to the Supreme Court of Science in the United States. National Academy of Sciences says that in 2012 we're going to experience some extreme solar flaring and solar scorching of the Earth. So just look to that date, but it's not going to switch on like a light bulb. Rather, it's going to gradually increase like a dimmer switch on a light.
Yeah, it'll ramp up slower. But it's ramping up now.
Yes. So we've got to get prepared for it.
Everything just gets progressively more intense.
Right. There are things we can do. Now, for example, the roofs are going to get blown off of houses. What I did was I got a special roof put on. I needed a new roof anyway. So I got one. I found a roofer who does the job very well, doesn't use staples, puts copper nails in right along the line where you're going to have secure shingles. I got the highest maximum withstandable wind speed shingles that you can get. Spend an extra $1,000. This is the kind of thing people have to do. With your windows now, there are what's called a plastic shield. There's a company called Gorel that makes a plastic plate that fits in between the multiple panes of your window. And you could throw a 2x4 at that. You could shoot a 2x4 straight at that window, and you might crack it, but you won't get through it. You're going to need that kind of protection, and if you don't have the money, what you can do is get these window guys to cut a piece of that plastic and screw it down over the outside frame of your regular double-pane window. So basically what you've added is another outside plastic pane. You've increased the thermal insulation and also gave you tremendous anti-hurricane and anti-straight wind destruction, which is going to come. We're having hurricanes right now. We experienced one yesterday. Windows will be blown out. So these are the things we have to do to protect ourselves.
Okay. All right, guys. So in the closing minutes, this next visit by Wormwood, you guys aren't saying this is the last, this is the end. You know, this is the tribulation. You're saying we've got to go through another round after this one, you think?
Well, no, the next thing that you can look for to happen, the next really dangerous thing, is that list of events that I put on the website is called the Sixth Seal. And that it's a list of events that are peculiar. The Chapter 6 events in the Revelation get progressively more specific as you go from 1 to 6. But the Sixth Seal is a list of events, and they happen in a fairly short space of time. Now, as we approach the June solstice line or the December solstice line, that's where the Earth is most vulnerable. So it'll be during late June, early July, or late December, early January, when the sixth
SEAL event list erupts, and anybody can go on the web and look at millenniumprophecy.com, and there it is. There's that list of events. You know exactly what to look for. But it's when we're near, you know, the June-July era, part of the orbit, or the December-January part of Earth's orbit, that's when the greatest intensity, we're the most vulnerable at those two points in our orbital positions.
Okay, all right. Well, that makes sense, guys. Now, just in the last few minutes, just want to put in another plug for next week. You guys will be back next week for 2 full hours. So, folks, you know, if you didn't get enough discussion on Planet X, Wormwood, with John DiNardo, Gilbert Erickson, they're going to be back for 2 full hours next Wednesday. Johnny Hayes will be back, so you're going to have a rip-roaring time with them. Guys, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you guys for coming on. Let's, you know, we'll get your contact information at the end. Oh, I got one question for the chat room. There's always this last-minute guy wants to know about HAARP. Is there any connection with HAARP? Is there any connection with the government trying to divert Wormwood and avert it or anything like that?
There'd be not enough energy in all the HAARP systems on planet Earth to make even a fly speck difference on Wormwood. Wormwood's too big, too fat, too heavy, too destructive. You could throw the entire planet Earth at Wormwood, and you wouldn't even know that it had hit.
Okay, well, here's the meeting. We're out of time, guys. John, Gil, we'll have you on next week. Great having you, folks. Thanks for listening. Johnny, be back next week. This is Andy Nunes for Johnny Hayes, New World Order Disorder, saying goodbye, and God bless you all in the name of Jesus. Have a good evening.